The following podcast is intended for a mature audience. Listener discretion is advised.
They'll say, well, I'm not interested in sitting watching a film where a guy in a hockey mask saws up teenagers, but that guy is, and frankly, that's weird. There's something wrong with that guy, because I don't have the urge to watch that, and he does. And it's probably because he's dysfunctional or dangerous.
If you say the real life fills up your days and you don't have time to play, well, midlife is the best time to start a new role playing thing. Sit down to game again. Rescue!
Hello, rescuers. My name is Che Webster, and this is Roleplay Rescue, the podcast about rediscovering our lost roleplaying hobby. Today, you'll be listening to the third and final interesting conversation that arose during the summer break. This one is on the topic of fear, and my guest is, of course, none other than Peter Laws. For those not in the know, Peter Laws is an ordained minister with a fascination for the macabre, an author, journalist, film critic, public speaker, and regular writer for Fortean Times. He is the creator of the Matt Hunter novel series and the host of the Creepy Cove Community Church podcast, an immersive, horror-themed church service broadcast from the mysterious fishing town of Creepy Cove. Besides from horror, Peter is said to hail from somewhere down south and enjoys retro TV and Krispy Kreme donuts. This is Season 9, Episode 16, Talking Fear with Peter Laws.
Rescue!
So, welcome to the show, Peter. Thanks for joining us.
It's great to be back. I always like coming on this show because we explore some great ideas. You ask some great questions, and it's nice to be back with you again. Thanks for having me.
You're too kind. So I wanted to talk about the value of invoking fear and threat in stories and in entertainment generally. And obviously, Roleplay Rescue being about gaming, role-playing gaming as well, there's a really good tie-in here. The horror genre is huge within the hobby as well. So I know that's kind of a very broad thing, but I thought that would be a general theme for us to explore.
Yeah, sounds good.
So I think the basic question is, why do some people seem to actively seek out and indeed enjoy, you know, invoking fear and a sense of threat? And why do some people avoid it like the plague?
Well, yeah, and I think it's good to point out right at the start that there are two distinctions, that there are people who enjoy it and those people who don't. Mm. And so at the very start of a discussion about this, there has to be a recognition that not everybody thinks the way you do. And so, you know, it's very easy, I think, for some people who are on one side or the other, who will say, let's, for example, say if you're really into extreme horror, let's say, or you're quite happy to throw in very shocking images in gaming or in films or novels, that, you know, you might really look at the people on the other side who don't like that and see them as like, what's wrong with you, you wuss? You know, like just grow up, or like, you know, just this is part of life. It's not real. Just deal with it. Whereas the people on the other side of that will potentially look at the other people and think like, what is wrong with you? Like, why are you making light of these massively serious subjects that are, you know, that it might not be true in the game, but it's reflecting reality. You know, it's kind of, it's got echoes of real trauma and pain. So I think, yeah, at the very start of a discussion like this, you have to go in being willing to see things from the other point of view, as well as having your own point of view. For me, I think my point of view on this topic has maybe changed ever so slightly, in the sense that I tended to have been always the type who just goes for everything and really happy to see the most extreme stuff, or I don't have any, you know, like really quite enjoying really morbid stuff, and I still do. But I think even since I was on this show last, I think I've had some experiences that have made me recognize that those people who don't like that, that they're not just, you know, there's good reasons, and there's good reasons for me to be thoughtful and cautious about not just sort of putting something really shocking in their faces. So yeah, I think right at the beginning, you kind of want to accept when it comes to this topic, there are kind of two different sides, and each side, they do have logic to each side, I think.
Yeah. So, I mean, for me, it's a mixed bag because I'm not a massive horror fan. So I guess it's good that we can have this conversation. I'm married to Deb, who is, as you know.
Yeah.
It's really interesting about like where I do intersect with this kind of stuff. I guess talking from my own experience, you know, I love the horror films that tread around the strange, the supernatural.
Yeah.
You know, apparitions, ghosts, and all that kind of stuff, right up my alley. I'm happy with demons. I'm, you know, I'm cool with mummies. I'm happy with the occult, witchcraft, even Satanism, I will admit.
Yes,
You know, spirit boards, Ouija boards, all those kinds of, those kind of invocating, all those kind of ideas. No problem really with snakes and rats. I know some people were freaked out by that sort of stuff. But body horror? You know, the closest comfort I got to with that is probably John Carpenter's The Thing, which I was at 1982 or something. But that really put me on edge. I mean, a great film and I did enjoy it, but it was the edge. And over the edge for me was Seven, which I vowed never to watch ever again.
Was that because of the whole film or like how it ended, or was it like a combination?
I think every single scene of that film pretty much put me on edge. And by the end, I was like, I don't know. I actually can't remember the film very well. I think my brain has kind of gone reject. But I found it interesting because, you know, recently I've been revisiting horror and Deb has been showing me films I hadn't seen. And that's been interesting as an experience. And again, reflects back to this thing of why are we seeking this? You know, what is it that some people love and some people just really cringe from?
Yeah, because I mean, you make a good point there because you're reminding me that, as well as having these kind of two sides, let's say, of like, I love the scary stuff and I'd rather not have it. There's also these nuances in between. There's like spectrums of, so like you talking about not liking certain things, but being open to others. I know other people, for example, my wife is quite happy to watch a film which has got a serial killer and is maybe gory and violent, but she would struggle watching like the Amityville Horror or The Exorcist or something. So yeah, you're right. There are certain kind of bespoke buttons that we have that touch on things, which is another reason to kind of respect the other person. You know, if say you might be doing something with another person, you'll go, oh my word, they've got a problem with that. Like that's not a big deal. And you don't know what that's touching on. You know, like I bet, you know, with your struggles with body horror, I don't want to get all armchair psychologist on you, but there may be reasons for that. You know, there may be kind of deeper reasons why you find that weird or unpleasant, and so you respect that. But yeah, but in the midst of all this, you know, like the idea of why, let's say the first group would be quite happy to dive into the discomfort of it all. I think there's various reasons. I mean, firstly, it's just, it is just plain fun for those people. And it is for me, it's almost like, I don't know, there's something attractive in things that are unattractive, which is quite strange, but it's the same principle of, imagine if you're with a friend and, you know, they're eating their packed lunch and they open it up and they go, oh, that something's gone wrong with this food. It absolutely stinks. And they clamp the stuff down and they say to you, that's the worst smell I've ever smelled in my life. I wouldn't wish that on anyone. I think a lot of people, including myself, would say, pass it over here. I want to smell that. You know, and I don't know. It's curiosity. It's interesting. It's fun. It's a new challenge. It's a safe challenge ultimately. So there's something kind of attractive about things that are unattractive because it's just novel and it sparks our curiosity. I have this. This can sound really weird, right? But I'm when it comes to, let's say, people who I find attractive. So I'm I'm heterosexual, so I'm, you know, attracted to women. Not every woman, but, you know, some women. And sometimes I find myself, I am more interested in looking at the people I don't find attractive, because I just find that interesting. Mm-hmm. So I might see someone and I'll go, she's not my type. And I'm like, how interesting. I wonder why she's not my type. And I'm like just looking at these people, just trying to work it out, because I just find it fascinating. So some people are weird like that. But the point is, you know, people, it's not weird to be interested in the novel, because the brain is wired for novelty. It's we survive, I think, evolutionarily speaking, because we are looking out for the thing that doesn't fit. Because that could be a threat. So if you go to the to see a stand-up comedian, let's say, and a piglet comes walking on the stage, your brain is probably going to go like, "Whoa, forget the story. Like, look at the piglet, because that's out of place." And so for me, particularly in the work I do with like the world of the morbid, and my book, The Frighteners, which was trying to defend the morbid streak. Was kind of making the point that we live in a world where we don't have a great deal of morbid stuff on our doorstep for real. We tend to, thankfully, depending on where we live, but most of us don't have daily experiences of actual death and horror. Going through a pandemic, you know, actually that is a bit different, because it brings those things closer to home. But a lot of us, you know, don't see, like, say, real violence in with our own eyes. And so that's actually quite novel. So when that comes up in stories or in films or indeed in games, our brains go, you should probably pay attention to this. So I think there is a logic to being attracted to that. We might even find it instructional, some of this stuff. I've talked about this sort of thing before, about zombies, and one of the reasons why zombie apocalypse scenarios are so popular still. In a way, I'm a long-term horror fan, and I thought zombies would have been gone by now, but they just, well, they don't seem to die, but they really don't, you know, they just keep on coming, and you, at some point they'll probably die out, you know, culturally speaking, but they keep coming. And one of the reasons is not just because it's cheaper to make zombie films than werewolf films. It is, of course, because you have to pay for a transformation sequence in a werewolf film. It's way easier to make someone look like a zombie. So there's some practical reasons why zombie films keep getting made, because they're cheaper to make. But also, they speak into, I think, a kind of a worry with modern people that maybe we're not prepared for an apocalyptic scenario. Like, maybe we would be in trouble. You know, if like you saw what happened with the Suez Canal earlier this year with the Ever Given ship, and it just sort of goes skew whiff and holds up a bunch of ships, and then it actually starts affecting the world very quickly in terms of deliveries and stuff. And I think we're conscious about the fact that the World Health Organization said something like we're 9 meals away from anarchy. And once your family have not eaten for 9 meals, they're going to start turning on their neighbors and stealing food and stuff. This, I think, plays on our mind a bit. And so stories and things that are about conflict and fighting, and particularly the zombie apocalypse, which is survival, security, protecting yourself and all that, they're attractive. So there's various reasons, I think, why people would be drawn to subjects which, in a way, you'd think, well, that's not very nice. But they're interesting, they're novel, and they could even be instructional. That's some reasons.
It's fascinating to me. I mean, we have lived through 18 months, 2 years now of global pandemic, where we have seen the fragility of our society laid bare, let's be honest. And yet, as I understand it, watching horror films numbers are up on Netflix and Amazon Prime and all those kind of places. And you sort of wonder, in the heart of that, when we're locked in our homes and can't go out, we want to watch zombie films, slasher flicks, and, you know, murders, basically.
Yeah, but also, ironically, disease movies. You know, like, so when COVID hit at the beginning, the top films on Netflix were things like Contagion, the Kate Winslet film. It was a really, really good, realistic sort of film. about a pandemic, which turns out to be a kind of like a documentary of what's been happening. And yeah, and again, and this is one of the other reasons, which I didn't mention before, but another reason you could add to the pile of why people would be drawn is, I mean, these subjects are relevant, you know, suffering. You're talking about body horror. Body horror, I find body horror scary in the sense that it talks about the rebellion of your own physical body. That's a scary thing, particularly when you get older. I think, you know, I'm 46. I'm of an age when I'm conscious that, like, you know, my body is changing and I'm finally going through puberty. No, I'm only kidding. No, like, but it's, you know, I had to get glasses earlier this year, the first time I've ever had glasses. And I was thinking, oh, that actually was a big deal for me. Cause I thought, oh my word, that was so my eyes are deteriorating. That's kind of scary. And therefore other things will deteriorate. So some people would therefore say, that's such a scary thing. I don't want to think about that. Other people would say, that's scary, but I don't feel comfortable acting as if it's not in the world and pretending it doesn't exist with my head in the sand. So I want to address it in a way that I can handle. And this is where entertainment and games come in, because that's when you can say, look, I don't want to get my head around this pandemic too much. I don't want to go to the hospital and actually witness people dying of COVID. That's way too traumatic. But I don't want to act as if it doesn't exist. So I'm willing to let these dark themes come into my entertainment, because of course, entertainment is much more than just entertainment. It's art. It's like reflection. It's trying to understand what we're going through. So these things all have functions, and to think that art and entertainment would not explore things that are so relevant to us, like death and suffering, violence and whatnot, is kind of absurd. I think it's normal for people to, well, it is normal because we've been doing it for centuries and still are.
I'm interested as well in the rise that we've had in our society of talking about the desire for a trigger warning, or as it is in gaming, the X card, which is something that a tool that is placed on the gaming table. And if someone's uncomfortable, it's a piece of cardboard with an X on it. You tap it or point to it and then play stops. My favorite invocation actually of this particular thing, which you won't know, but I'll just tell you, is from a children's game. No Thank You Evil by Monty Cook Games. Monty Cook Games having championed the whole kind of consenting gaming thing over the last couple of years. No Thank You Evil literally has the rule, which is the No Thank You Evil. When you say No Thank You Evil in the game, you stop the game dead, and that we stop what we're doing in scene, whatever's happening, and we have a conversation about, okay, what's uncomfortable. And then we can edit that from our game experience, and then we can move forward.
Oh, okay.
But it's interesting that it's a game design. I mean, obviously for older children, you know, like my age, but also right the way down to, you know, into primary, really. You're talking sort of 5, 6, 7 year old children and up. It's real fantasy kind of different genres. It's got a fantasy genre, it's got a science fiction genre, it's got a horror genre bit to go to, and yet you have this kind of, you know, No Thank You Evil, that's enough for me, or the X card, I'm just going to stop here.
Yeah,
it's connected to this trigger warning, or the warnings we see on every film and every TV at the top, you know, contain X, Y, or Z. But I remember growing up in the world of the 70s, where I was, I think, probably scarred for life. I think that is the title of the book, isn't it?
Yes.
by things that came with no warning. I'm thinking about building sites bites, and I'm thinking about the kid drowning in the pool.
Oh, yes. Dark and lonely water.
There we go. And all that stuff. So what's changed is what I'm curious about.
Well, Before we go into that, just an interesting thing about those childhood, particularly in the 70s and all this sort of hauntology type stuff, or the idea of the kind of the haunted generation and people perhaps of our age who were traumatized by many things on TV. I know I've got plenty of experiences of things I could point back to and say, I can't believe they showed that. And that traumatized me. But the irony is that... when you look at people who are this age now, they look back at those things with great love and affection. So there was a vote amongst adults to say, like, what was your favorite public information film, and at the top, I think Charlie Says was at the top, which was the one about a cat saying, you know, don't talk to strangers, and it was really creepy about, you know, like weird pervs and stuff asking you to get in their van, you know, not the sort of stuff you're like, oh, can you remember yesteryear when we learned about pedophiles? You know, it was scary, you know, scary stuff, and Dark and Lonely Water as well, as in, I'm sure that was in the top five. And yet now you go, you look back at the scare experiences and you actually think that that was important somehow, or that meant something to me. And I think that's one of the things that's worth saying about these scary experiences, is that they're not just about what happens at the time. They can be scary and frightening, but they can end up becoming, well, it can be very useful, because they can teach you to be careful. Fairy tales, for example, there's talk of some parents wanting to defang the fairy tales and not and not include the really dark sides of them. And yet actually, you know, the fairy tales have a good function in precisely because they're scary, because they teach children not to trust everybody. And so even though, like, you know, I'm sure as we go on and talk, I'll share this, but even though I am very respectful of the trigger warning system, and I think it is wise to recognize that some things really are disturbing, particularly people who are suffering from mental health issues, that actually some things can make them spiral into a pit of despair, and you think, well, is it worth it? Shouldn't I let them know? So that's all very sensible. But at the same time, the other scenario is, well, are we trying to create a culture in which we are never exposed to disturbing things, or we are given the option and then we opt out of disturbing things and we never get to experience that? And there are actually some positives and negatives to that, not least with children. Let's say children who say, look, mommy, I don't want anything scary. Just read The Gruffalo to me every night, or just read The Hungry Caterpillar, as lovely as those stories are. But you kind of need some stories that say, there's a child catcher who may murder you. As scary as those are, they are teaching children, don't trust everybody, be careful, there is actual danger out there. So it's a tough balancing act. I agree, definitely.
It's fascinating to me. Back around about 2002, 2003, I think it was, there was a game designer and called Ron Edwards, who talked a lot about lines in gaming, and coming from a sort of talking about the stories and narratives. What he was talking about is the lines that people have, some people don't want to cross. Yeah. And yet many people, and he was encouraging people to slowly and with little steps, but cross those lines. But the first question, of course, is what are the lines that you have? You know, what are the boundaries, if you like, of your experience that you're usually prepared to function within? And then, you know, using the medium of role-playing games, where we enter into a fictional character's mind and we try to take on the role of a fictional character, and we completely fictional situations, yeah, we then explore what it would be like, what it would feel like, what we might choose to do, you know, what the consequences of those choices would be. He was encouraging this sort of idea of, like, just push that, you know, and see what happens. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, as a person who's on the side, which is, well, I don't want to say sides in the sense of like it's a war. I want to mean just like, I'm the type of person who does enjoy scary things. Let's put it that way. And so I do like the idea of going beyond the line, but that's because I find that usually entertaining or exciting or interesting. I must admit, I do have some personal lines, but not many. So, for example, I remember when I was, well, before I had children, I used to get really annoyed that more kids weren't killed in films, because I used to feel it was a cop-out. I'd be like, this is, you know, you'd watch a film and some kid would go missing. This was like in the olden days. And I'd think, well, I'm not even worried, because the kid's going to be fine. They always survive. Or if they find the kid's body, when they lift the sheet up, you're not going to see a dead kid. So I'm not worried about seeing the shot of a dead body. And I used to think that was a cop out, you know. I was like, if this is horror, just like get in there and show us horror, shock us. But then I had children myself, and I don't think you have to have children to empathize with this at all. But this is what changed for me, is when I had children, I remember My wife and I rented a film called Gone Baby Gone on the day that we brought our baby back from the hospital. And we were still in our mindset of like, oh, let's just watch a thriller. It's a Ben Affleck thing. Oh, it's about a kid going missing or something. Cool. All right. We just saw it as a pure thriller. And then I don't know what had happened, but well, we had a baby, I suppose. But like we were watching this and both of us says, I don't know if I can watch this. And I was like, this is so weird. Like my line right then had gone. Yeah. And I was like, oh, sorry, it solidified, I should say. And I was like, I feel weird. Like I've got a kid upstairs and I'm watching a film about a kid being like kidnapped and tortured or whatever. I can't remember. Mm. So the lines can change. But having said that, I still am the sort of person who mostly I quite like things that are willing to take a step over. And occasionally I get shocked at things. There's a film called Kill List, which I'm not saying it should be banned at all. What I'm saying is I watched that and I felt very uncomfortable. I was like, I don't know if I want to watch this. There's something about the violence in that. Or there's films like I Spit on Your Grave, for example, which I think is like a rape revenge film, which I actually think is quite a good feminist message that, you know, women can take control, you know, and respond to the horrible men in their lives. But me sitting at home, like watching scenes of like brutal rape is not really my type. Do you know what I mean? I'm not saying that's a line that therefore that should never be depicted in art, because it's a reality and it should be addressed in some way, but not in a way that's kind of frivolous or titillating. So there are certain things that I'm just not particularly into, like sexualized violence just makes me feel uncomfortable. But a lot of other things I'm quite open to. And sometimes people get shocked at that because I'm a Christian and ordained as a minister as well. They'll assume my lines are really, really low. So, you know, I could be out with people and they'll swear and say, oh, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that. Or like, oh, you wouldn't like that. Or, oh, well, that was an 18. You wouldn't have watched that. And I was like, wow, you got no clue. You got no idea what I've watched. So, yeah, there are lines and different people have lines. And there is something about pushing beyond the line, which I think can actually help us to deal with some of the things. You know, if you've put a line there, it means that it's there's something significant about that issue. And it's up to you. You shouldn't be forced into going beyond the line, but going beyond that line may be a way of learning courage in the face of that issue, possibly.
I think as well, it's about who you're sharing that experience with as well. I know that in a simple sentence, for example, if I'm watching a film that's going to put me into a vulnerable state of mind.
Yeah.
I mean, let's think about some of the things we haven't really touched on that can come up. That I get really uncomfortable with cancer in a film when it's depicted graphically, for example. Mm-hmm. It's a fear that I guess I picked up from when I was younger. Now, yes. If I'm doing that with you know, Deb and my wife's in the room and we're watching together and we're kind of cuddled up and there's a film and it's that and I get uncomfortable, that's a very different experience than when I'm hanging around with a bunch of buddies I'm supposed to be like very, you know, comfortable with. Or even say different from being in the auditorium with a bunch of strangers to me. And that's on that level. Now, when it comes to like role-playing games where this is friends meet or potentially friends meeting, you know, around a table or whatever to actually, you know, have this narrative gaming experience, again, it's even more personal, I think. Maybe it does matter, like not just what the topic is, but who we're discussing it with or who we're experiencing it with.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. And it'd be interesting to see. So just, you know, the three scenarios you described there of being with your wife in a kind of intimate position of watching a film, let's say, that has these topics, and then with friends, like which one of those do you feel the most vulnerable in the face of this topic?
So for me, I would allow the vulnerability would surface with my wife.
Yes, yeah, I thought you might say that, yeah.
But actually, I may well be really not wanting to be in that experience. I would feel uncomfortable. I wouldn't be able to express that discomfort as easily with, you know, with strangers, for example. And yes. I wonder if that matters.
Yeah, I think it does. And I think this leads us to what I think is one of the core issues about this whole topic, which is it's to do with having distance between us and the topic and having the right amount of distance, because I think for me, this is the thing that it kind of explains it. And it's that for basically there are some things that many of us feel fine with and are happy to watch it, but it's when the distance between the topic and our reality gets shorter, that's when it becomes much more difficult. So for example, the idea of disease and watching a film with disease in it, you know, when you're with your friends and stuff, you might not be thinking about that topic in quite the same way as when you're with someone who you're willing to be vulnerable with. And you're willing to say, gosh, like we're growing old together and I'm worried about this. And my bravado, I'm quite happy to put that to the side. And so naturally there's less of a distance. And it's the same thing with, I suppose a good example would be, like, it would be very easy, I think, for us to have, if someone announced at the West End they were going to start a Titanic musical, like a, you know, maybe there's one already, but a musical theater extravaganza all about the deaths of everyone who died on the Titanic, most people would be like, yeah, that seems reasonable, you know. It's a little bit weird, but they do Titanic everything, so that seems okay. Why? Because the distance of time has put the Titanic tragedy into a box where we can handle it, because it's far enough away. And because it's far enough away, it doesn't touch us in the same way as, let's say, if somebody now tonight says, let's pitch a musical theater show based on the current Taliban takeover of Afghanistan, Pete would be like, too soon, you know, like, no, like that's a live situation. People are dying now, or people are facing torture now. Enough time hasn't passed, you see, so we don't have the distance. And so because we don't have the distance, we it hurts us. It's much more painful than real. Now, there would have been a time, let's say after, like, soon after 9/11, where people were so shocked by that they could even barely make comedy anymore. I watched a documentary about Late Show, the history of the Late Show in America and different kind of late night talk shows, and how in the days after 9/11, people were just like, we don't even feel capable of making a show. And they were even thinking, we don't know if we would ever make a comedy show again. That's how painful it was. But in time, films like Cloverfield were made and starting to address this issue. And then films specifically about the Twin Towers. And then just a few days ago, I discovered that there's a 9/11 musical that's apparently based on one of the planes or something, and it's people singing about, well, I don't know what, but there would have been a time when if you'd pitched a 9/11 musical on 9/12, people would have been like, how dare you? You're trivializing that. But actually, time has passed, and it's all about distance, you see. And so I think we can apply this to personal fears and sadnesses and stuff. So you might find that if you're in a group of people, let's say you're playing a game, and for some reason someone, is this going to be about disease? I'm not keen on that. Or another person says, oh, this is about like kidnapping, or it's about domestic violence or rape or something, or it's got those sorts of themes. And they might be like, I want to hold up my no evil card, or I'm not into this. And it would be very easy for you as a person sitting there going, it's just a game, you know, like your big wuss, like, just, or, hey, you know, I know it's not nice, but use this to address your fears. But it's easy to say that when you have distance between you and the topic. Whereas there are some people who just, they don't have that distance. They may have experienced these things. They may have grew up with facing these issues. They might have never told you, and why should they? You know, it might be their private business, but there may be reasons, or it just might be a topic that touches a button for them.
Yeah, I think that point is a really important one, the idea of the touching the button. And I think that's perhaps where the X card idea has its truest value. Having been a person who last year, you know, went through a sort of a snowballing of anxieties and into depression, knowing what those triggers were and what was going on, you know, with the pandemic and all things. But it's interesting to think that actually I could be at the table. I'm personally aware enough now to know that I'm probably not aware of all of my triggers. And therefore, you know, when you're sitting at the table, you might think to yourself, yeah, you know, I don't know, a scenario where there's a severe weather thing going on and there's hurricanes and tornadoes and people are getting swept away and destroyed and homes are being destroyed, you know, and there's all that kind of stuff going on. It sounds all right to me. I've not actually experienced that. Probably okay. Yes. But who knows? You know, and actually, in the moment of play, there could be something else that develops from that thematically or something that just touches you. And to be able to say to your friends, you know, in a kind of calm way, ooh, hang on a minute, to me is a healthy thing to be able to do, I think.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. And it's a far more honest scenario in which you can say that. It is, I suppose, a critic could come along, and I'm voicing the voice of a critic rather than saying what I think, but a critic could come along and say, well, you know, if this had been the 80s, you would have just got on with it. Or maybe that approach, who knows, there might be a point to this, may had in itself kind of lessened the effect of it, you know, but we can never know that. I think all we can know is like what it makes us feel like now, and those things can really upset people or send them on a bit of a kind of downward spiral. And so I think you do respect that, and you also accept that, like you were saying earlier, there doesn't have to be a logic to these triggers. Like for example, I don't have claustrophobia. I don't think I have it. I'm not aware that I've ever had it. And yet, like earlier this year, I had a bit of a stressful experience. It was quite a very stressful experience actually. And I remember having like this went on for a few weeks, this stressful thing. And after it, I was doing my podcast, and in my podcast, I do kind of strange news and bizarre things going on in the world. And somebody, a listener, sent me a story in which before that month, I probably would have just thought, this is such a cool, dark, macabre story. But for some reason, it just really disturbed. Shall I tell you this story? It's a claustrophobic story, but guess like, so to let people know what that is, but it's very quick, but it was a news story about a father and I think his son who was in Spain, and they were walking in a city, I think it was near Barcelona, and they saw a papier-mâché dinosaur, which was part of an art installation. And for some reason they looked inside, and when they looked inside, they found a man. And a man weeks earlier had, I think he dropped his phone inside the dinosaur, and the phone had fallen down the hollow leg of the dinosaur. And he had went in to try and retrieve the phone and fell head first and got trapped and died inside the hollow leg of the dinosaur. Now, previously to this stressful experience I had, I think I would have just said, whoa, that's so dark and it's horrible. It's a real person, but that's a kind of thing to tell around the campfire. But while I was in the midst of a stressful time, I just found that so distressing. And I almost couldn't think of it. I was like, I'm going to have nightmares about that. That's awful. I hate it. Why did you tell me that? I thought to this person who sent it in. And it's things like that that make me respect and understand those who may live their life in a perpetual, you know, state of the roller coaster of anxiety and depression. And so I do, you know what I mean? I want to respect those people by saying, I don't want to just throw things in that might make, not only might make them give them nightmares, but might unfortunately make them check out of a positive experience of play. You know, like, you know, what do you do when you come together to play together, or you come together to watch a movie together or whatever? You want that camaraderie and that place, safe space to say, hey, yeah, I'm with my friends, I'm doing cool stuff. And the thought that a topic could suck you out of that. It's not just about the topic. It's about the fact you've been sucked out of that situation. You may be beating yourself up and thinking, what's wrong with me? Why can't I just get on with it like everybody else? And it isolates you from your friends. So these are serious things, and they're unpredictable. There's not always a logic to them. I'm not fully sure why I was worried about a guy upside down in a dinosaur leg, but it's probably to do with feeling trapped or something, you know, like pretty obvious. And after that, I have started to be more respectful of people who, you know, who might might put their hands up and say, oh, do we have to do that? I'm not just going to say yes. I'm going to say, oh yeah, do we have to do that? Do try it a different way.
It's interesting. So far, we have made the assumption that there are a group of people who love this stuff and are curious about this stuff and want to explore the macabre and the dark, you know, because it's intriguing in some way. And then there are a bunch of people who are essentially not comfortable with it. Essentially, we might say anxious about it, afraid of it, that the fear is in itself the barrier. Is it possible that there's a group of people who are actually just disinterested in these things, that they're actually, they're not affected by the horror and the fear? You know, a slasher flick is boring because, I don't know, it's just not of interest. Have you come across those people?
Yes, I have. And in fact, I've come across quite a few of those people. And the author, Lynd Hatcher, describes it helpfully, I think, where he says that, you know, some people have the spooky gene, he describes it, and some people don't. Yeah. I definitely have the spooky gene, but some people just don't. And by that, he means, like if I'm sitting in a group and then suddenly if people talk about football or whatever, I'd be like, okay, right, going along with it. But then if somebody says, you know, oh, did you ever see that film about the Conjuring film or something? Oh, my friend's got a Ouija board. What do you think of that? And I'd be like, really? Right. And I'm in the room really interested because I'm fascinated by that sort of topic. The people who don't have the spooky gene view these topics in a similar way as maybe I do with football. You know, it's like, well, it's not that bothered about them. Mm. And what's interesting, though, is I can just look at a football and say, oh, well, you know, I'm not that interested, but I don't have a problem with people being into it. But sadly, when it comes to these morbid topics, people who are just not that interested in this stuff, a lot of them can't just leave it at that. They'll say, well, I'm not interested in sitting watching a film where a guy in a hockey mask saws up teenagers, but that guy is, and frankly, that's weird. There's something wrong with that guy because I don't have the urge to watch that, and he does, and it's probably because he's dysfunctional or dangerous. And so this is the irony, particularly when it comes in the church scenarios where you get a lot of books in Christian circles who will sometimes say, you know, don't watch horror films, don't watch violent films, don't play violent zombie video games or whatever. And sometimes you can tell the way the author talks about it. It's like, why would you want to anyway? You know, it's much more fun to go and see, you know, a comedy, or it's much more fun, more rewarding to watch a drama. And you think, you just don't get it. You know, like, so you're dismissing other people's interests because you're just not interested in it, but you've added on top an explanation of why people are interested in it, and it's a negative one.
Yeah.
So it's I do think there are people in the middle who just aren't that bothered, and some of them, that's fine, but some of them use that as an excuse to bash those who are.
I've recently been rereading Seth Godin's book.
Seth Godin,
he's a marketeer, American marketing expert and business person, and kind of social commentator, I suppose.
Oh, yeah.
And he's written a book called The Practice.
Right.
Now, in there, he talks about how, with art, the creation of art, he's calling people really to go to the edges of whatever they're into and really push the edges of that. You know, he talks a lot about, like, you can't get outside the box. What you can do, though, is you can get to the edge of the box and use it as leverage, you know, sort of like go to the extreme of something within your...
Yes.
He talks about, like, with art, for example, in modern art, you know, what those all artists were trying to do. And he says, you know, many people don't get that art. He goes, but the point is, it wasn't meant for them. It wasn't made for them.
Yeah.
It wasn't for them. And it's okay that it wasn't for them. And he talks a lot about the difference between the sort of mass market middle of, like, general popularity and actually how the fringes are where, you know, really the art is created all the time. You know, but at those fringes are people who are, well, by the judgment of the middle, a bit odd.
Yes.
But of course, what they're doing isn't for them. And I've always seen, personally, you know, the macabre, the horror and that sort of stuff, and what I do in terms of fantasy and science fiction and gaming and role-playing and all that, mm-hmm. as, again, out on that fringe. When people are critical, when I was at church and that people would say, oh, you play Dungeons & Dragons, you must be a devil worshipper. In my, you know, as a young person, I was like, what are you on about? But now I sort of think, well, yeah, you don't get it, and it's because it's not really for you, and it's sort of okay.
Yeah, yes. No, you're right. And the irony is, of course, as well, is that, you know, when it comes to, say, culture, what happens is the mainstream culture in the middle is doing their mm-hmm. thing and forgetting that probably what's popular in the mainstream was mm-hmm. discovered on the margins, on the fringes at one point and was new. And then the fashion of culture pushes it out. And then an example would be, I watched a great documentary the other day about the Bee Gees and their kind of their historic sort of impact on the music world, and how they didn't used to be kind of disco and they weren't really known as a disco act, and yet they did Saturday Night Fever album, and then that became like the biggest selling soundtrack, and certainly was about the topic of disco. Mm-hmm. But there was a time at the beginning of disco where it was kind of really fresh and new, and everyone was listening to kind of easy listening stuff. And there was this kind of music coming out. I was like, whoa, what is this? It's like really kind of repetitive and rhythmic. And it sounds really interesting. And then that became so popular that it gradually took over everything. And so disco became in the center of culture. And so you would get disco Christmas Carol albums, or everything was disco. And, you know, every film would have a disco, even the Amityville Horror has a disco mix, you know, or it's Friday the 13th Part 3 has a disco mix. You know, disco is everywhere. And all of a sudden it came in the middle, and then you got these kind of more rock DJs saying, death to disco, you know, we shouldn't like this anymore. And they're burning disco albums. And it's just this cycle of like, what's in the middle goes to the outside. So what's on the outside goes to the middle, gets so popular that gets rejected. And it's just, and to me, it's just a case of saying, well, just like what you like. And there's no rule. And so I got really annoyed at this shot of in this documentary of this rock guy saying, death to disco, we shouldn't have, like, come and bring and burn your disco albums. Like, as if there should be rules into what you like. You should just like what you like. So I don't know how we got into disco from that, but but yeah, so there's these fringes and these mainstream things, and you're right. Sometimes horror is, you could say it's on the fringe, but actually, when you look at it, you know, I think the principles of horror are often found in mainstream, in the sense that, like, the biggest most popular genre in books, particularly in the UK, is crime fiction, for example, which normally revolves around a corpse. Or like graphic descriptions of death. You watch most Disney films, which are pretty mainstream. There's usually a death of a parent in that, and some sort of scary horror element. So I do think it's kind of threaded in. But yes, there are certain like out there horrors that end up on the outside and then gradually become in the in.
When I was growing up, one that stands in my mind is the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which was banned. And seriously underground when I was a kid. And yet I think now, is that pretty in the middle? I don't know.
Well, actually, I mean, I rewatched that not that long ago, and it's still pretty brutal. I think there are still moments in it which is just, I think the nature in which that film is made, it's so kind of down and dirty that there is something disturbing about it, even though there's not a lot of blood in it. But no, you're right, that there are certain things that you would have been, like the video nasties, you know, you would have been arrested for owning certain films that now when you would have watched them, they are so tame, particularly compared with mainstream TV shows like The Walking Dead or Game of Thrones, which are way more graphic and would have landed people up in prison if that had been released in the early 1980s. So, but I mean, the fact is, and going back to our topic, I suppose, is to say that culture is this big melting pot of ideas, and it goes through fashions and stuff. But human beings, even though we follow fashions, we still have the fundamental same hopes and fears. You know, we're scared of death or loss or loneliness, and we crave connection and security and understanding. And so our stories are always going to, I think, be a balance between those two things. And like we've been talking about before, it's like, it's just how do you balance those things? Mm. And so when it comes to things like trigger warnings and stuff like that, as important as they are, the other risk of it is to try and create a world in which we don't face the bad and the darkness, which has its own dangers. I think if you had, say, if you went to the doctors today and you were suffering from, they get you to fill in questionnaires and stuff, and they'll come back and they might say, right, okay, well, you know, you've scored a certain amount, we're going to put you on medication or something, and that can sometimes really be helpful. Or they might say, we're going to give you some sort of therapy. And there's a couple of different types of therapy, which I think indicate kind of what we're talking about. There's like cognitive behavioral therapy. I don't know lots about this, by the way, so if you know anything more, correct me if I'm wrong. And there's another one called acceptance commitment therapy. And these two are slightly different as far as I know. But I think in cognitive behavioral therapy, you're kind of trying to identify negative and destructive thoughts and trying to kind of change them, you know? So basically that, you know, our stress doesn't come from the things we're worried about, but how we're, so like actual things, but it's coming from how we view them, you know, and that makes sense because we can distort things and turn them negative. But in a sense, I don't know if that means that you've got to try and kind of think your way out of what is essentially sometimes a wild west of emotion, because you just don't know what's going to trip you or cause you issues. Whereas this other thing called ACT, which I read about, acceptance commitment therapy, was basically saying that you must be willing to accept that pain and discomfort are a part of life. And you must learn to almost live with them and allow them to live in your house, as it were. And I think the phrase is being psychologically flexible. So I heard an example, a kind of image described of this is like, imagine the stressful things in your life or the things that trigger you or scary things as like a monster who lives in your house. And probably like, think of it like Monsters, Inc., like a cute monster, rather than like the Babadook or something. I'm a bit too scary, but you know, like imagine like a little cute monster or something. And every day you get up and you don't know when this monster is going to leap out. You might be playing a game, and someone, or you might be telling a story, someone randomly just tells you a story about a dinosaur leg and a guy getting stuck in it, and you just were not expecting that to trigger you, but it did. You can either say, oh crap, that monster's still here, like I'm obviously failing in my reprogramming in my brain, or you know, I'm clearly not strong enough for this. Oh, I've fallen back into, or you just accept it and you say, oh yeah, that's just something my mind does. It kind of throws that at me. And it's just a thought, you know, it's me thinking about something bad. It doesn't necessarily, it's just what I'm focusing on. And I'll just label that thought and kind of just gently put it to the side and think about the other thing I'm doing. And it's like dropping the rope from struggling with this monster and just learning to say, oh, well, the monster is there. And so I don't know whether or not that is a, well, I suppose for me, I find that a helpful way of doing it, because some of the things that disturb me are things like death. Like that's one of the reasons why I'm into horror, because it helps me deal with death. And the problem with that topic is, you know, I've got friends, for example, who their issue is they think everybody hates them. And you know, and they'll go to parties, or they'll, you know, just they'll be with friends or something, and they'll come back and they'll just say like, I know they all hate me. I know they were only pretending. They weren't really laughing at my jokes. They don't want me to be in that group, you know? And my heart goes out to them, because I know that's not true, but it's easy for me to say that because I've got the distance from that sort of thinking. And so with that person, you can understand, yeah, it'd be good to try and get a person to, if they could, to think a different way, because what they're thinking isn't real. But there are other topics, like for me, if I'm worried about death, well, I can't say like, oh, I'm a bit stressed about illness and death. You know, somebody else can't say to me, it's like, don't worry, that's not real. you know, well, don't worry. That's that, you know, that's just your that's just you being stressed about something, but it's fine. Actually, that's going to get more real in my life the older I get, and friends dying and all that sort of stuff. So actually, that's when you want to have a level of accepting the darkness, and learning to live with the darkness. And this is where, you know, in a way, it prompts me to want to be the top, like a bit more brave. And to say, okay, yeah, so let's say we're playing a game and we're gonna do something, and they've told me that's scary, but actually maybe I will dive into it, even though it's stressful, because I want to try and face it. I don't know, I guess it depends on how you want to picture your life, as a tragedy, or, you know, to sound conceited, but as a kind of hero's journey. Like, you can view your life in those two ways. And the same circumstances can be there, like stresses and horrible and setbacks and stuff. But I think for me, it's like the hero's journey thing inspires me, because I think, well, all the best adventures are scary. And so therefore, if I want my life to be a bit adventurous, I should expect there to be villains, and I should expect there to be pitfalls. That doesn't make the pitfalls fun, but it gives them a different perspective than I am at the mercy of a cruel universe, and I'm rubbish and pathetic, and this is what I deserve. You know, it's a different setup, but that's easy for me to say, because not everyone thinks that way.
Peter Laws, thanks very, very much for your time. Hope you've enjoyed it.
Yeah, I have. It's a bit, oof, we get into some depth, eh?
We are. But no, thanks so much for coming on and talking about this. I'm just conscious of time, so.
Cool.
Good night.
Oh, thank you. Good night.
Big thanks to Peter Laws for talking to me again, and I hope that you found it interesting or useful. If you want to hear more from Peter, check out his Creepy Cove Community Church podcast at creepycove.com. I'll stick the link in the show notes. Presented in the style of a church service, his immersive, horror-themed podcast shares spiritual insights, comedy, and strange church music direct from Creepy Cove, a mysterious, haunted fishing town by the sea, where every horror movie happened for real. Think of it as a safe place to encourage you, only with monsters and stuff. As ever, if you have questions, please drop me a message via anchor.fm/rpgrescue, or email your sound recording directly to hello@rpgrescue.com. And that's it. My name is Che Webster. This is Roleplay Rescue. Thank you for listening. Game on.